Is presented by the writers and illustrators of the future. They've been providing a means for new and budding writers to have a chance for the creative efforts to be seen and acknowledged. Welcome to Chatting with Sherry. Tonight we welcome award-winning author, editor, and publisher William Joseph Robert. We had a really fun conversation about writing and books and about his adventures in publishing and editing. It's a really fun chat. Here's William. Hi, William. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
How are you?
Good. Just look forward to the weekend. Got things to get done, garden to set up. It's going to be a pretty weekend.
Yeah. I think it's going to, well, it's cold for us here. It's in the 60s. And it's 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And for us,
we end up being like high 70s or low 80s this weekend, looks like.
It's beautiful. I mean, it's really sunny. If you look out the window, it's gorgeous. But, yeah, to me, it's cold. As thin-skinned Californians. it was like in the 30s. Last night. It was really cold. So that is cold.
Yeah, it got down slow here. It was enough that I was afraid that the blossoms on the apples were going to freeze off. Hopefully we got pollinated so we don't lose any fruit this year.
How do you know, when do you know something got pollinated?
When the flower petals fall off and the fruit starts to form. But, you know, if you have a frost come through that kills off those blooms, you just killed off all that possible fruit. But if it's gotten pollinated before the frost, you're good. It'll still continue to grow.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's really interesting.
Yep, and like, I don't know if we're going to have any plums this year because I'm pretty sure a frost got it. All the blooms started popping out, then we got a frost. It's like, I don't know. So it's just, we're going to have to wait and see if we'll get any fruit on it.
Oh, I remember those days. We used to have a plum tree, a pear tree, and what was the other fruit tree? I can't remember. I think it was an apple tree. But we used to have that in our backyard. Yeah, it was so cool.
I've got blackberries, blueberries, kiwi, key limes, pomegranate. We've got elderberries growing, apples, cherries, figs. I think it's all the fruit. Oh, and aronias. They're similar to a currant.
You know what I think of when I think of elderberry wine?
Monty Python.
No! Arsenic and Old Lace. You remember the wine?
I was
wine?
Just Monty Python.
I think of Monty Python too, but that's the first thing that comes to my mind is those sweet little old ladies with their cute little walks who are killing old men with their elderberry wine. I mean, it's such a funny movie. I think it's like a very early movie for Cary Grant. He's hilarious in it.
Like the mid 40s?
I think it's earlier than that. I think it's like the late 30s.
Okay. Because I know which one you're talking about, but it's been a minute since I watched it.
I love it. This is a Halloween fairy tale that takes place in Brooklyn, New York. I mean, that's how it starts. You know it's funny.
Yeah. I remember that part.
Yeah, it's at the beginning. It's written.
Okay.
It's a little thing. at the beginning. I haven't seen it in a while. A couple of, that's another holiday movie I like to watch. We were talking in the green room about holiday movies, that's why. But yeah, elderberries always make me think of arsenic and old lace.
And we end up making our own elderberry syrup, and we save it for cold season and stuff like that. And when we had our own hives, we were using the honey from that to make the syrup.
Do you keep bees?
We did. And then we found out that honeybees are the number one thing that's probably going to kill me if I get stung by it. So we stopped tending to bees. That didn't turn out well when I got stung one time.
That's highly intelligent to stop when you figure that out.
But it's so peaceful to watch them when they're sitting there and, you know, they're on the front board and trying to cool the hive down with, you know, they're all flapping the air into it. And just to watch them flying out, and you see the new ones take their orientation flight. And if you ever see a beehive and you see this one bee fly out and it does this spiral upward, that's the orientation flight. That's a brand new bee that's getting its bearings to figure out where it's at. And it's just beautiful to watch them.
Interesting. I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember. They've had so many murder mysteries with bee stings. And some, you know, how it's been set up in different ways that someone gets stung.
Mm-hmm. Well, they had that in, like, the Hunger Games, too, I forgot what they called them. They were a hybrid hornet yellow jacket thing.
Oh, that's interesting.
And you know, she ended up knocking a hive off of a tree and took out a bunch of the other contestants.
Ooh. That's not good. I mean, I've never seen The Hunger Games.
The book is better. The first movie, I don't know about the others. The first movie wasn't bad, but the books were wonderful.
I've had that recommended, but I never read it. I haven't gotten to it yet. Yet. I mean, you know, my list is so long, I don't think I'm going to live to read the entire list.
I think it's every reader.
Yeah, I'm actually doing one of my AIM books, you know, one of the big books. I'm reading Middlemarch. And, but because it's so slow going and long, I'm reading other books at the same time.
Unfortunately, my entertainment reading has been getting sidetracked here lately with editing and all that, but I'm still getting to read some great stuff, because,
mm-hmm.
you know, that's one of the joys of the publishing side of things, is I get to read beautiful manuscripts, and I get to help give birth to them.
Yeah.
And put them out there to the world. It's awesome. You know, there's a big bit of satisfaction from that. And then helping them to, hey, well, what if you did this and this and this and tweak that? And like one I just finished edits on yesterday, she wrote it as a one-off. Like, no, okay, so you got to take off the last three chapters. You need to do one new epilogue after this, you know, after chapter 27, wrap that up. Okay, now you got to set up for book 2 and 3. She's like, but no, that's how you need to do this, because that's the way it reads. There's more there. She's like, okay, I think I can figure that out.
Yeah, that would be interesting. I've known whether mine is a series or not, so I never actually, I know when mine's a standalone and when mine's a series. It would be interesting to have that editor say, oh, well, you got, it reads like a series, you got to write. I've never had that happen. So, but she must have been like, huh? Oh, wow.
This particular author, she has a bad habit of writing long or trying to pack way too much in too short a piece. So her short story is like, this isn't a complete short story. There's more here. You got to just write a novella or a novel with that. It's like, okay. She's just long-winded, or she tries to pack way too much in, you know?
Have you ever noticed that some of the great classics are novellas?
They are, yeah. But,
Like,
you know, at the time, you know, you go back, like, turn of the century, 20s, 30s, you know, paper was an issue.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the smaller the publication, the more they could save and this and that. And, you know, they went with some tiny font in some of these things. I've gotten some of these used books. It's like, I can barely read this.
Oh, I've had that too. And such a disappointment when I can't read it.
But, you know, you also have, like nowadays, you've got these tomes that, for me, as a slow reader, I've got dyslexia. And, you know, seeing a book that's 150,000 words, 200,000 words, and it looks like a tome on the shelf, I'm like, I don't know if I want to read that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the old school little pocket novellas, novels, like, you know, some of the Mack Bolans or the old Westerns, things like that, it's something I can sit down and read on a Saturday.
It's just like the time machine is like, I think it's like, was it 100 pages? I mean, it's really short.
Yeah, it's not that long, really.
And
a lot of them were like that. Robinson Crusoe.
Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
Yeah, they were in the 50,000 range, I think, if I remember right.
Yeah, I mean, they're really short. Really short. Great Gatsby, another one that's really short.
Yeah. And, you know, I tell my authors, because they're like, oh, I don't know if this fits. Is it too long or is it too short? It's like, the story is as long as it needs to be. You know, yes, the big four, you know, the big trad publishers, they put these stigmas on, this needs to be this long now, and this must be this long, and thou shalt. And it's like, well, no. Because, you know, you get some of these newer novels, and you can tell where it's fluff. And it's just fluff for fluff's sake to make that thing bigger. But it doesn't add anything or add any value to the story.
And the thing is that the reader knows.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, there's some, like, you know, I love David Weber's writing. But I personally will skip over his physics lesson on, you know, what it takes for that missile to fire from this ship and be able to strike that ship. He does, you know, hard science fiction. I'll skip the physics lesson because I don't want that. But the rest of his writing is beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, but that does add fluff and add content to the books. It's just, you know, it depends on what it is and how it's set up.
That's true.
You got to look at that particular readership. And some, they don't care as long as you got a good story.
That's true. I mean, like I said, I actually watch BookTube. I find it fun. And for those who don't know, BookTube is YouTube where they talk about books. So it's hashtag BookTube. But I enjoy it. I watch several. And when you hear a review where they say, you know, this book could have been like 100 pages shorter, like, that's what, and this is when the people, the publisher, no, it's too short, you gotta throw stuff in, gotta stretch.
Yeah, and
but readers know it.
You know, if you've got a good character, you suck in the reader with the character, what's going on, you know, the personal workings of the character. I find that writing in first person, I have just fell in love with, because I can really get into that character's head. And, you know, that's one way that you can easily add fluff on the writing side, is when you're mulling things over. Like, I'll do an introspection going into a chapter and then go into the story bit for that chapter, and then maybe you have a little introspection again on the outside of it. But it lets me get in there with that character and really touch base with the readers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I put a lot of emotional stuff, I put personal experience type stuff in there just to be able to resonate.
That makes sense. That makes a lot of sense, actually. I like character-driven stories, but it has to have a good plot, too. You know, you can't be a...
And you got to have some action in there.
Mm-hmm.
But if the story is, you know, it reads like a bad sci-fi channel TV series, it's just like, no, I don't want this. I want to go on an adventure. I want to disappear. I mean, it's fiction for fiction's sake. That's why we read it. You know, but I don't want it to be like somebody's just reading the script off to me. So,
yeah. I wasn't surprised. I actually read a science fiction book, and I won't say what it is because I don't want to hurt the author's feelings. But I read the science fiction book, and I was like, this is really weird. You know how you read a book sometimes and it's very cinematic? Like,
yeah.
Right now I'm reading Around the World in 80 Days, and Verne wrote very cinematically. I mean, you can see why they made so many movies of it, and miniseries of it, because it's like every chapter, it's a scene. It's so cinematic. But sometimes when you read a book, it's like they took a movie and expanded it. It's like one of those novelizations of a movie.
Yeah.
But this wasn't a novelization of a movie. That there is no movie. And I read it. I'm like, this is just the strangest book. And they had sent it to me to review. And I said, what is the basis of the story? Because to me, it feels like you took a movie and expanded it. It feels like a novelization.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, yeah, actually, it was, I did write a movie script, and I couldn't get it produced, so I just made it into a book. I could tell.
Now, The Time Machine, that was another one that was written so well that you could picture it all like it was a movie playing in your head.
Absolutely. It's beautifully written.
One of my authors, I swear, he writes as good as David Eddings. I love this guy's fantasy, and he writes his scenes so cinematically that you don't notice the head hop as you're reading through. And it's just a cinematic pass off from one character to another. And I'll get like another chapter or so down the line. I'm like, wait a minute, hold on. And I'll back up. And he wrote it so well that I didn't catch it the first time because I was sucked in. It's like, okay, dude, all right, you can't have 7 head hops in one scene. You got to change this out so it's one of these characters, pick this guy, rewrite that. But, you know, it's just done so well. And that, you know, some of the older stuff, they wouldn't have even thought about head hops and stuff like that. And that's a lot of the same similar patterns that they used to do. Lovecraft did a lot of that too, especially when he was trying to get into the head of the character who is seeing the thing that's not even there, or it's in the shadows, and you know, he's ramping up the horror and the stress.
I actually I'm not a horror girl, so never read him. I know who he is, of course, but
Some of his stuff, it's dry, but other stuff, it pulls you right in, and you're feeling the vibe of the story. I mean, just like if you're reading some of the older Bradbury stuff.
Oh, I love Bradbury.
He was a master of horror.
Bradbury? Ray Bradbury?
Yeah, the old, like some of the stuff he was submitting into, like, Weird Tales and things like that back in the day.
Oh, I only read his science fiction, so I didn't know he did horror.
Yeah.
I love him. I met him. He was a nice man.
He'd have been one that would have been nice to meet.
Oh, he was. I met him 3 times. The first time was in community college. He came to give a lecture. He was so cute. He was supposed to do, what's the name of it? The Wicked something. Oh. Wicked Way. It's from Shakespeare, for God's sake. I can't think of the name of the book.
I know what you're talking about, and I can't think of it.
Anyway, he was supposed to talk about that book, but he didn't want to. He wanted to talk about dinosaurs, so that's what he talked about. Isn't that cute?
That's cool.
I know he was. He was so nice. And then after the lecture, That was my last thing that I was doing. So I was waiting. It's like where the lecture area is. It's also where the student hall is, and they have a little area where student parking is right there. So I was waiting for my dad to pick me up, and he was waiting for his daughter to pick him up, and we were standing next to each other, and he kept looking at me, and he said, "Were you in my lecture?" I go, "Oh, yeah." And he said, "I thought so." And he just started chatting to me. I would never have approached him. I would felt like I was encroaching on his privacy or something, because, you know, he was Ray Bradbury.
Yeah.
But he was just so friendly and nice, really. And then I met him at a couple of conventions, and he broke a rule for me. Because we were told I had two books. One was for me and one was for my dad. And we were told we can only have one book signed. But he remembered me. And I said, "I know you're only supposed to sign one book, but this is for my dad. You remember he picked me up?" And he said, "Sure." And he just said, "No problem." And he just signed both for me.
That's cool.
And he wrote instead of to my father's name, he wrote to dad. Isn't that sweet?
It is.
He was just the nicest man. He was so lovely.
Most are, and that's one thing, like baby authors, you know, trying to approach some of the bigger names, they start doing the fanboy, fangirl thing, and you know, any of the upper end, they're going to go on defensive mode at that point, and it's a whole other game. But when you talk to somebody like a person,
mm-hmm.
it's a whole other experience.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I met Richard Matheson. He was a lovely man, too. Another book signing. And I broke another rule.
I'm seeing a pattern here with you.
I know, I'm bad. Well, he was there for, why can't I remember the name of that book? I have it sitting in my living room. It's the one that Robin Williams did in the movie. You know, about the he's dead and he's trying to find his wife.
I'm trying to think of it.
I can't remember. Isn't it sad getting at that age in my life? Anyway, so
all the other stuff that we fill our heads with.
I know all the other stuff. So now, listen to this. I remember the other book because that's the one I broke the rule with. I had bought the new book because I wanted to read it. But I also, because I never knew I was going to see him again, I brought Somewhere in Time. See, that came right to my head.
That's a good one.
And I said, I know you're only supposed to sign your new book, but I really love this. I worked at Universal when it came out, and I saw it before it was released, and I've loved it ever since. And I love the book even more than I love the movie. Would you mind signing it, please? And he goes, "Oh, my God, of course." He goes, "Oh, my God, you're a fan."
That's pretty cool.
And I said, "And I remember you in the movie, too." He's in the movie. He's when Christopher Reeve comes out from shaving, and he's got little peepers all over his face because he's never in his life used a straight razor. He's the man who looks at him and shakes his head and like, "Oh my God, what an idiot." He doesn't say a word. He just shakes his head. And then there's another scene with him in the elevator. That's when he first is there and he sees that the elevator's door open, and he sees he's actually back in time, and the man is behind him, and he says, "Excuse me," and that's him too.
Okay.
So if you ever see the movie, now you know where Richard Matheson is. But it's a really good movie. If you've never seen it, it's a. But the book is so much better. It is such a beautiful book. And it's so. You can't. You know, a movie. I love the movie, so it's not a. It's one of the most beautiful movies that I've ever. Time travel movies I've ever seen in my life. And. But the book is. It's so deep. It's so beautiful. Have you ever read it?
No. I've seen the movie, but I've never read the book. But that's generally how it works, though. I mean, you can only do so much in a movie.
Yeah.
The books are almost always better.
Yeah. It's such a beautiful book. I'm such a nerd. When I got the book, we were going, my parents' anniversary, they always wanted to stay at the Del Coronado Hotel, and somewhere in time, the book was set in the Del Coronado Hotel, so I read somewhere in time where it was actually written and set. I was so proud of myself.
This nerd moments we don't get on the East Coast that often.
I mean, oh, that was like the most beautiful book nerd moment in my life, reading that book. And then, you know, I'm reading it in the morning, I'm reading it at the pool, I'm reading it at the beach. Whenever I wasn't doing something with my family, I was reading it, because it was just, oh, exquisite. And that was the first time I'd read the book. I found it with the picture. I know people that are bookies don't like books that have the film cover on it, but I'm weird. I love the film cover on it. And it has Christopher Reeve and Jane Seymour in a beautiful picture. So that's what I got autographed too. It was my that's what they call it, movie tie-in. I have the movie tie-in with Richard Matheson's signature. Is that cool or what?
That's pretty cool.
But definitely read the book. It makes more sense why he dies at the end. The book makes a lot more sense than the movie does.
Okay.
Sorry, spoiler. If you've never seen a movie or read the book, I apologize. I'll give a warning at the beginning of the show.
There you go.
But it's just, it makes more sense than it does in the movie. Okay. Because you don't really get in the movie why a healthy young man dies. Even after all the stuff, even if he didn't eat for 24 hours, you know what Christopher Reeve looked like. He just did,
yeah.
Superman. He was a strapping young man. Even if you don't eat for 24 hours, you're still going to live the next day. You're not going to die.
Yeah.
You know, it didn't make sense, that part. And then when I read the book, it's like, oh! You know, you now I understand. See, I'm not spoiling the book.
It's all good.
But definitely, definitely read the book. So... I wanted to ask you about your association with the Writers of the Future. How did that start?
I started submitting. I've been submitting to Writers of the Future for years. And, you know, going to all these conferences and things like that, I've got to meet John and Emily and Joni and all of them. And at one point, I just started emailing back to Joni and like, oh, thank you, you know, for the reminder, blah, blah, blah. And just chat with her every now and then. But, you know, there's a lot of contests and anthologies and magazines and stuff like that out there. And Writers of the Future is one of those contests that actually is done on the merit of the work. It's not just a popularity contest. You know, that's one. Everybody puts a lot of faith into the Dragon Awards and the Hugos and things like that. The popularity contest. Nobody's reading it. It's not done on the merit of the work. You know, Imaginarium, the Imagine Award. They're reading through the titles. And they're selecting by jury of which ones are winning that year. And the same thing goes for Writers of the Future. So, you know, it has value because it's actually on the merit. Now, you've got to get through their battery of judges.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And I'm one of those that haven't yet. I've gotten silver honorable mentions on a lot of titles. Just can't get past that hump for whatever reason. And, you know, I've went back and I've looked at the different titles that I've submitted. It's like, okay, well, this one probably had too much violence. This one had a little too much cussing in it or something, or just the content was off. So, you know, I've went back and done my own self-reflection and evaluation of the titles to see where I can improve and how I can adjust it. And, you know, it's like anything else that you're submitting to, you've got to look at who you're submitting to. You got to read the content. You know, what are they publishing? What are they accepting? What usually wins? And once you have that idea, it makes it a little bit easier to write something for it.
That's true. That's true. So do you buy the book every year? Is that what you do?
Not every year. I've been going to Superstars Writing Seminar the last couple of years, and I end up getting a copy in the little tote bag they give you. But before then, I was buying them, or I'd get it on audio so I could listen to the titles that won. And that just gives me an idea. And, you know, like, before it was Dave Farland, you know, he was the coordinating judge.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, okay, well, what does Dave like? And that's what I was trying to wrap my head around. And, you know, unfortunately, he passed away.
Yeah.
And Jody and I took over. So, okay, so what does Jody like? And started trying to look at what she's selecting and what's winning now and get an idea of that.
And so when you go to the seminars, who's talking to you? Who lectures?
Well, it depends on what the seminar is. I mean, Superstars, you've got Kevin Anderson, Jonathan Mayberry, Jim Butcher. I mean, there's a whole slew of names that come to these. And, you know, I try to pick up as much information as I can. I mean, you get some of these seminars where it's a low body count, you have more of an opportunity to talk directly to them. Instead of it being a lecture, it becomes a discussion.
That's more fun.
And you get to learn more.
That's more fun.
Yeah, and anytime that I'm on a panel and I'm, you know, moderating or running it, it depends on how many people is in the room. If we've just got a little crew, oh yeah, we're going to turn this into a roundtable discussion. There's no lecture. There's no whatever. We're going to discuss whatever we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether it's aliens or post-apocalyptic survival or whatever. And it makes it more enjoyable. It makes it more entertaining for those people that paid to be there. And that's something else a lot of baby authors don't think about. You know, if you're getting on panels at a convention or one of these expos or something, and they got panels up there, you're the entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
You're why people are coming to these things.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to be entertaining. You have to put on a show. And, you know, some of them get up there and they play Eeyore and they're woe is me, life is not good, I'm not getting the writing I want. No, don't do that. No. You keep it up. You keep it up tempo. You make sure that whoever's sitting out there in that audience is enjoying themselves and they want to come back next year.
Yeah. My first panel was at a small con here in San Diego. And I was scared just doing that. And I ended up sitting next to Larry Niven.
Larry is beautiful people.
He was so sweet. And he just, I told him, he goes, "Are you okay?" I go, "Just nervous." And he said, "Why?" I said, "It was my first convention. It was my second panel." And I said, "The first one was okay, but it was a smaller audience." And he goes, and I said, "And this one's big." And he goes, "Just act like you did during the first one. You'll be great." I mean, he was so sweet and so encouraging. But yeah, I mean, I can understand how I would never woe is me. And the last thing someone you're promoting your writing. You don't want to say, "Oh, I'm not doing what I want, and I'm not getting enough money." But what writer does get enough money?
Yeah. I have seen it time and again. You know, they get up there doing that, or they start changing it to where it becomes a pedestal. Mm-hmm. You know, they get their little pulpit for that minute. Like, okay, any good moderator is going to diffuse that.
Oh, yeah.
And shift the discussion into something else so you don't go down those rabbit holes. I kind of took over a panel at Dragon Con this past year. It was a post-APOC panel, and the moderator just kind of sat there and did nothing the entire time.
I had that too. It was like, come on.
This one lady, she was an educator. She was all about self-sufficiency, all this kind of stuff, and it was we were doing the town, or you know, the community versus the loner in the post-APOC, you know, how does that work and all that. And we started talking about, you know, okay, so who's doing work, who's farming food, who's taking care of basic things like washing clothes, and who's taking care of the children and education, you know. And we went through this whole gamut of stuff, and this one lady, she went on this tangent, and I kind of took over the moderator position and started steering things away from where she was going, because we had a packed room full of people.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah, no, let's not do this. We ain't getting political. We ain't doing that. We're going to go over here and we're going to play.
Yeah, I've had that too. I tried not, especially when I was new, I tried not to be a moderator. I didn't want that responsibility. You shouldn't be a moderator if you've never been on a panel before.
No.
That's a little foolish, but I did get brave, and I put together a team of people, and I for Comic-Con here in San Diego, and you know, it was a small room, but I had a really good panel, and the subject was how to make money. How to go from writing fanzines to writing books, because that's what I had done. And I had all these people who did the same thing, who were fanzine writers, who were in media and different things. And the room was packed. I mean, they were standing along the wall. So, you know, I had to keep the thing going, and I made sure that I bounced it onto the most entertaining people in the group.
Yeah, and you have to share the wealth, too. You have to call on people, because sometimes people just won't speak up until they're called on.
Mm-hmm.
And
you
have to call them out.
I made sure every single person on the panel talked. Not once, but a few times. I went down one way, and then I went from the other side, that person was last. I started with them and then went back up.
Well, and, you know, that makes for an entertaining panel. That makes it to where people want to see that again.
Yeah, it was fun. It was really fun. And everybody loved it. I got so much good feedback. You know? I not just from the fans, but I guess the fans talked to the organizer, and I got a really nice letter from the organizer saying that everybody loved yours. It was just great.
That's good.
As I'd never been to Comic-Con before. I'd never done my own panel before. It was all new to me, and I was really scared. It was one of those times when it's really good to be an actor. I was I was squeezing this bottle of water on the trolley to going downtown. I almost exploded it. Because I was just squeezing and squeezing and squeezing. I was just so nervous. And my brother, who was sitting next to me, said, "Sherry, that thing's going to explode." I said, "I'm sorry." I put the water down. But you get nervous.
Unfortunately for riders, the majority are introverts. And getting up on that stage to talk about your stuff is so tough. It takes practice. It's one of those things you just have to keep doing and get it done. Unless you're lucky as all get out and you hit it right off the bat where, sales are going like crazy. You got to get out there and talk to people so they get to know who you are, they get to know your work.
Yeah. That's why you go
And
to conventions.
in my solo talk that I give, I've given it at a couple of different cons now, like an Imaginarium. I'm giving it at JordanCon this year, and I've done it at the Superstars a couple of times. One of the big things is like finding what will help you to don your armor, whether that's a hat, a jacket, a vest, a brooch, something particular that you put that on, all right, you're in game mode. You're the entertainer now. You're ready to get out there in front of people and nobody can touch you. And it, I ride motorcycles. And I had my wife and my mother-in-law take my oldest pair of coveralls from when I was in the Air Force. I was an aircraft mechanic. And I had them turn that into my riding vest, for the biker community, it's called a cut. And it comes from the cutoffs that they originally did when they first came back from like World War II and these guys formed the clubs and stuff. So I had them take this thing, chop it down into the vest, took my squadron patches, my deployment patches, sew all that on there. And initially, that was what I rode for or wore riding the motorcycle. Well, now that's become my armor when I get out there and go to the cons. Just as soon as I put it on, it's like, all right, it's game time. Let's go.
That's interesting. I mean, one of my friends. Okay, I'm a big fan of Indiana Jones, and one of my friends is also a big fan of Indiana Jones. She dresses like Indiana Jones every time she goes to a convention. That's her armor. She dresses like Indiana Jones.
And it works. I mean, well, that's one of the things with cosplay. Some people, they would never be out there doing things in front of people normally, but when they get to be in cosplay, that's a whole other thing. They get to be somebody else.
Yeah. I just never done that,
It's a
though.
psychological trick.
I know. I know, and it's good. I get into the veneer of, okay, you're a writer, so that's your persona. You're a writer. But acting writer, not me, Sherry writer. Me, Sherry writer sits and types or writes longhand or whatever way I feel like writing. I'm very quiet. I don't bother anybody. Sometimes I do it at home. Sometimes I do it like at a Barnes and Noble or something, or at a restaurant. But it totally, that's my private, insular, not non-friendly, but more private. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
If someone comes that I know and talks to me, of course I'll talk to them. But I'm not going out of
Yeah, but
my
that's
way.
different.
Yeah, because they know I
You're not
know
on
them.
stage.
Yeah. Oh no, on stage I'm Sherry the writer. I'm Sherry the writer who wrote these books, and I'm here to talk about my favorite movies or science fiction or whatever the panel's about.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a different me. Yeah, and some people act so weird at, you know, I was on a panel, and this person who was a person I knew but not very well, I knew him through the internet. They had people sending them flowers at a con at the end of the thing, like she's at the Oscars or something.
Yeah.
I was like, or on stage of a play. And I'm like, why are you doing that? This is not a play. Why are you having people give you flowers? Yeah. It's just strange.
Some people, that's their thing, you know.
No, if you're in a play, yeah, you get flowers on stage. That's normal. But not at a con, not on a panel. I was like, I cannot believe that she's doing this.
I don't think I've seen anything like that before. In worst case, I've seen people just bring things that they've made for whoever the author was.
Well, that's fine. This was set up. This was a friend of hers, and she had her bring her flowers. This isn't a fan giving a gift to a writer that they like. That's fine.
Okay.
That's acceptable. And usually they don't do that while you're still up on the stage.
No.
This happened while she was still up on the stage. And one of the people in the panel was a really well-known person. So I was very embarrassed by her doing that.
Oh, Lord.
Yeah. Yeah. It was like, oh my God, she did it right in front of her. But yeah, it just like I said, if you're in a play, absolutely, that's when you get flowers. You get, you know, you get gifts, whatever people are going to give you. And when you get off stage, the fan wants to give you like a little present that like they knitted or they crafted or something. That's beautiful. But not while you're up on the stage where the panel is. That's just not polite.
It's rude.
Yeah. Downright rude.
It's not showmanship, it's just show stealing.
Yeah. Yeah. I was so embarrassed. Yeah, you just don't do that. And also, if like a fan is doing that, that's from their heart and that's private. And I've never had a fan come up on in front of everybody while everybody was still sitting and we just ended and people were still applauding and do something like that. You know, a fan will wait and then come as people are packing up and moving off on the stage, or they'll wait till you get off the stage and they'll hand you something. That's different,
yeah.
And that's beautiful. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, it's just like, you know, when I first got to meet Tracy Hickman, my first appointment, we had a little library, and it was just a shelf in the rec tent. And it was whatever books that people would finish reading, they put over there to share with other people.
Mm-hmm.
And I got the first three Dragonlance Chronicles books. All three of them were there. I read through them like four times during that deployment. Kept me sane. And at my first Dragon Con, I got to meet Tracy Hickman. And I went up there and thanked him for what he had helped create, because it got me through that deployment. Now, one of these days, I'll get to meet Margaret, and I'll get to do the same with her.
Cool.
But
yeah.
It was after the panel was over. I waited to the very last because people were getting autographs. And just, all right, y'all do your thing, and I'll go up there last.
Yeah, that's polite. That's the way you're supposed to be. That's exactly the way I am. That's the way almost every, no, not almost, every normal person is like that.
Yeah.
When I talk, I wait my turn. I even to a lot of Xena conventions. I can't afford them anymore. They're just it's creation is really expensive, so I just can't afford it. Not that I don't want to go, not that they don't do a great event. It's just that I can't afford it. But when I used to be able to go, and I had a photo opportunity with Lucy Lawless, and it was great. But all I could say is, "Oh, I really enjoy you on the show." I totally was starstruck. I couldn't even have a normal conversation. She was sweet as pie, and as soon as I left, I'm thinking to myself, "You are pathetic. You couldn't even have a normal conversation with someone."
What was it? Last year, Dragon Con, Jewel State was hanging out at the Westin Bar, and then anybody that hasn't gone to Dragon Con, the Westin Bar is the unofficial author bar. So after panels are done and all that, that's where all the authors hang out. Well, Jewel State and a couple others were hanging out there, and I finally got to meet her. That was awesome.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my good friend's wife, she was dressed as Kaylee from Firefly. And I just looked at her. It's like, you know, Jewel's over there at the bar. She's like, wait, what? I'm like, yeah. And I just grabbed her hand and took off with her. And my buddy Casey Moops is like, yo, Billy, what are you doing with my wife? Just shut up. And I drug her over to the bar. It's like, Jewel, this is Cassie. Cassie, Jewel. And I just walked off and left him there. And he was freaking out. And there's like, he was like, where's Hillbilly taking her? I don't know. Everybody calls me Hillbilly. But I just deposited her there. She got to have her moment, and she was totally speechless and smiling ear to ear the rest of the convention. It was beautiful. You'll probably want to shoot me for doing that, but it's okay.
I love that. That's great. Yeah, I know. Yeah, some conventions that they it's the bar, sometimes it's the restaurant. The Xena convention, it's the restaurant. It's like, because it's half bar and half restaurant.
Okay.
And I used to go there and be a little girl on the side, just watch and listen. But I made friends with every. They come on my show because I made friends with everybody at the convention.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, Stephen L. Sears, who was the producer and writer of one of the writers of Xena, line producer.
He did A-Team and Airwolf and a couple others too.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. We became really good friends. And he came on, he was one of the first people that gave me a shot with my podcast. I didn't even know what I was doing when I interviewed him the first time. And he's like the most, he always is so helpful and positive and he really is, he believes in people. And like when I asked, should I do it before I even did it? And he goes, sure, why not? And when I started my Sherry's Playhouse, I told him about it. He goes, oh, that's a really good idea. I'll tell you what, I'll come on your show. We'll reverse it. I'll interview you. And that's what we did. But, that's from talking to him quite a bit, and becoming friends. The cast from Xena is a very friendly group of people. They're really nice and down to earth. Definitely worth knowing these people.
Yeah.
So I wanted to also ask you about your publishing. What do you publish? What books, kind of books? What's the name of your publishing company?
The publishing company is Three Ravens Publishing. We were just strictly genre fiction, but we've opened up to more. Pretty much anything across the board. I'm waiting on word from one of the partners to make a decision on what we're doing with romance. Because we're doing romance one way or the other. It just depends on what type of romance we're doing. But we're open to nonfiction, sci-fi, fantasy, horror, commercial style fiction, like something you'd see it on like a Hallmark movie or read in Reader's Digest type of things. The main thing is it needs to take us on an adventure. We don't accept anything that is message fiction at all. But as long as it takes us on an adventure, it has an opportunity to possibly get published. We had so many submissions that I shut down cold submissions until December because I had to get caught up on the backlog. And we're a small publishing house, so there's a very few hands doing a lot of work.
So do you have people that are the readers, or do you guys read yourselves?
For what, like review readers or?
No, with submissions.
It depends. We will go through, we got the crew that goes through the slush pile and, reads the submissions and, puts their input in there, whether it's good, bad, not, don't want this. Oh, dear God, stay away from that one. Or like with the anthologies, I'll have a baby editor on board that will help me go through them, make the decisions on the which ones are going to get into the anthology. And, all the way up to I've got a deal with J.R. Handley and Bayonet Books where they're running a bunch of anthologies for me. They're sending me a final formatted document to go ahead and upload, but they did the edits and the selections and all that. So it's taking some load off of me while still getting content that we can put out.
And is it print on demand or is it regular books or how do you guys print?
Both. With print books, we go through Ingram first, and then I'll go over to Amazon. I'll load up over there with Kindle Unlimited. Depending on what it is, I'll go to ACX to set up audio, or I'll contract out with a narrator that I've got lined out, and we'll get audio set up to where I can go wide with it. And right now, I'm with everything that happened with Findaway Voices, I'm in the process of figuring out what homes we're putting our audio in. But I try to get things as wide as possible because I want our titles in library systems. I want people to be able to find them in other countries, not just in Amazon US. And that's one thing I hear from a lot of readers, like, well, it's not on Kobo, so I can't read it. Well, crap, that sucks. And I've started shifting things right now to where we're going into Kindle Unlimited, and when KU money starts drying up and we're not really getting the page reads on that title, then I'll take it off of KU and I'll go wide with it, so we can get it out to the wider audience base.
So do you do Libby too?
No, I haven't done Libby. We use Draft to Digital for the wide ebooks. And well, like I said, I was doing Findaway Voices for audio, but that's changed now.
Because I actually Libby is pretty good. It has a good selection of books.
Is it a distributor or?
Libby is the library. It's the West Coast Library.
Oh, okay. That goes under Hoopla, and there's two or three different library systems it taps into for the primaries. Hoopla is one of them. I don't remember the others off the top of my head.
Oh.
But that's all through Draft to Digital for the ebooks. With Ingram, you get distribution wherever they want to buy books at. Whether it's Barnes and Noble or the library wants to pick up a couple, they've got a good distribution system.
Because Libby does audio too. That's why I was asking.
Okay. That might be similar to the Pine system like we got here in Georgia.
I mean, I know that there's different library systems in not just in the United States, but everywhere. But that's the only one I know because that's the one I use. So I was just curious because, I mean, I would look up your books if it was on Libby.
Well, I'll have to take a look at that when I get back upstairs.
Okay. Do you have, for yourself, any books coming out?
I've got a slew of anthologies right now that we're processing through. My next novel is still in work, which is part of my JTF 13 universe. It's mill fantasy, mill sci-fi. But the next things we got coming out right now is it came from the Trailer Park Volume 3.5. We had so many good submissions for Volume 3, we decided to go ahead and do a double edition, and that releases on Monday, on April 1st. And then I ended up landing an IP contract, licensing contract with Steve Jackson Games, and we're doing fiction in his Car Wars universe. So it's post-apocalyptic gladiatorial car combat stuff. And we have an anthology that's coming out, I think, around the 15th. I'd have to look at the calendar. It's coming out mid-April. And Jody Lynn and I did the edits on it. I got a story from Steve Sterling, from Larry Dixon. Mercedes Lackey was nice enough to give us a blurb for the cover. And it's just a bunch of good, solid stories based in that Car Wars universe.
Cool.
So was it Go Hard or Go Home? A Car Warriors Auto Duel Chronicles anthology. Yeah, that's the name of it.
Okay. And do you have a website?
Oh, yes. You can find me at williamjosephroberts.com, or you can find Three Ravens at threeravenspublishing.com. And then if you do a search, you'll find me or Three Ravens. I've got like 20-some different social media pages between both.
Okay. All right, so if you go to the website, you'll find out what your social media is.
Oh, yeah, easy enough.
Okay. All right, I want to thank you for joining me and chatting, and it was really lovely. Thank you, William.
I appreciate you having me on.
Thank you. And thank you for chatting with Sherry.
Is celebrating 65 years in Southern Nevada with 65K in 65 days! Make a qualifying purchase in-store or fuel up at the pump, scan your Terrible's app, and spin for your chance to win free products. Or be lucky enough to land on
$1,000!
Every day for 65 days! So, download the free Terrible Social House app and play today! Spin more, win more! Terrible's, deliberately different since 1959.
Save on Cox Internet when you add Cox Mobile and get fiber-powered internet at home and unbeatable 5G reliability on the go. So whether you're playing a game at home,
yes, cool,
or attending one live,
no!
You can do more without spending more. Learn how to save at cox.com/internet. Cox Internet is connected to the premises via coaxial cable. Cox Mobile runs on the network with unbeatable 5G reliability as measured by Ookla LLC in the U.S. 2H 2023. Results may vary, not an endorsement of the restrictions apply.